Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest nostalgia interview to meet Sabrina Maley-Smith. And Sabrina, we've just been talking before we started recording about the role that nostalgia plays and the fact that, you know, maybe our children sometimes are interested in the things or maybe not interested in the things that we grew up with. But do you want to say a little bit, first of all, about what you're doing and why nostalgia plays such a big role in what you're working on?
Right, nostalgia is, to be honest with you, it's the thread that runs through quite a lot of the work that I do. So currently, I finished working on a novel. It will be my first novel that comes out, called Zazen. And this is a novel that's set in the 1990s in the Britpop era. And it basically details the emergence of Britpop as a kind of cultural phenomenon. Probably, we could argue, one of the last major cultural phenomenons really to do with music in the UK, perhaps. It's particularly UK focused. And yeah, it's set in the 90s and it traces the viewpoints of four characters, three of which are women and one is a mixed race male. And it looks at how an emerging Britpop band get confused with a dance music cult and hilarity and devastation that ensues from that. So it's written in the form of a meta fanzine, which is a fanzine that's aware of itself, because I wanted to sort of pay homage to the way that we found out about stuff and that we communicated before the internet. So we used to have little fanzines and music newspapers like NME, Melody Maker, Select, that you could go to your WH Smiths and pick up. And the fanzines you could pick up in record shops and stuff to tell you about stuff that was going on. So it's told in like sort of pages of this fanzine from different characters' points of view. Two of the characters are female journalists of the time that work for the oppressively hip subculture magazine. And it also looks at the music of the day, I would say, as well, and the kind of run up to what actually became Britpop. So the chapters themselves, they're actually a mixtape playlist, so you get a little bonus of some of the nonsense we would have listened to back in the day, perhaps some of the things that, you know, maybe people would have forgotten about too.
Yeah, and so, I'm just thinking, yeah, I mean, that's amazing, because I'm just thinking about the whole sort of inspiration for that, because obviously you're drawing on your own experience, but yeah. Also, were you sort of like going through lots of those very fanzines, those magazines, those, you know, records, well, literally records, but also, you know, documents from the period, or you know, how did you frame all of that?
Yeah, so there's many inspirations that come into this novel, many, many, many of them. When it comes to the actual form, I would say, rather than the content, so the form of the metafanzine, I unearthed a whole load of NMEs and Melody Makers from about 1991. So clearly this is what I did over this time, from about 1991 to about 1997, you know, because that was the way that we, you know, we used to get this information. I remember there was 70p, NME was far superior because it got staples in it. So you could sit on the park and read it and it wouldn't blow away. but yeah, I unearthed the whole load of them, dusted the cobwebs off. And I remember someone being really surprised, who was a little bit younger than me, who saw this collection and said, "Oh my God, they actually look like proper newspapers. Like you could wrap your fish and chips up in them," that sort of thing. So they remembered NME as an actual like magazine. Now, obviously it's all online. And then I did some DIY this summer and I moved them over again. And my partner, he actually said, he unearthed them and he said, "These should, you know, you should do something with this. This should become something. It should go in a museum. It should be an exhibition." And actually, I am putting on an exhibition. I failed to mention this earlier, but I'm putting on an exhibition in Leicester at the Adult Education College in October and November, all about NME and fanzines and a form of communication before the widespread use of the internet. So that's one sort of strand to it. Another strand to it is, I remember, probably about 8-10 years ago now, I remember coming home after a long week at work and sitting with my Chinese takeaway in front of the TV and watching BBC 3, and they'd have a lot of TV shows, documentaries, they're still on there now on the iPlayer actually, documentaries about like different musical scenes of the day. And there were a couple of Britpop ones. And I remember getting quite outraged and just like kind of going, "Oh," really, really astounded by it. The fact that it was all completely remembered as this sort of white male competitive Blur versus Oasis battle. Obviously that did hit the news, it was part of it, but you know, that was the major sort of focus, the drive behind this Rolling Stones Beatles sort of competition that had been going on, you know, since the 60s. And I don't remember it being like that at all. I remember that being an element of it. But as a mixed race woman, young woman growing up in that time, I remember it being an incredibly, it seemed like a very inclusive environment. So you had bands like Elastica, who were, you know, they're all, I think, predominantly female band, Jewish front woman, fastest selling album for 10 years, totally forgotten in those documentaries. You had bands like Lush. For me, that was the first time when I saw Mickey Bereny on TV, it was the first time I'd ever seen a mixed race woman who was half, I think she's half Japanese. On TV, and it was like, whoa, I'd never seen that before. You had bands like Skunk Anansie coming out in this sort of era as well. And I remember thinking they were, I mean, they actually were the last band to headline Glastonbury of the 20th century, because it seemed like that sort of music was becoming way more progressive through the 90s. You had bands like Echo Belly, you know, who the driving force behind them were two ethnic minority women. You know, there were loads and loads of bands that I could just reel off and reel off and reel off like that. That became the fabric and the framework of Britpop, but they're totally forgotten, hidden histories, you know, hidden memories, really. So I kind of got a bit, I thought, you know, if it's nostalgia, people only remember one accepted narrative of this time. And that kind of irritated me quite a bit. So that's when I sort of started writing bits of the novel that have now ended up becoming a novel.
And that's the key thing, isn't it? Because I think everyone, even if you've been to the same gig, even if you're, going back to the days when, I remember the charts used to be unveiled on a Tuesday lunchtime. That ages me. That was back in the 1980s, and it's people bring their ghetto blasters, and everyone would be sort of huddled around. But we'd all have very distinct experiences and memories because we all had a vested interest. Before we started recording, we mentioned The Cure, for example, and which made a resurgence. And yeah, in the 80s, some people would, would maybe turned off the charts because their bands, were not going to make the top 10 or whatever. But we were all there for our own different reasons, and yet we're all huddled around the same transistor radio, or maybe all at the same gigs, but kind of having different experiences. And I think what you've highlighted is so important, because suddenly when you find 2 decades later you're watching a TV program and then they're saying this is what encapsulates the decade, and you're like, it's like the days of, you'd watch the BBC, I don't know, the 6 o'clock news before the internet, and that was like, oh, what's happened in the world today? Teletext, or watch it on the news. And yet now you say, do you want to watch, is it the entertainment or the education or the politics or the business sort of stuff? And you sort of pick and mix in a different sort of way. And you look back and you think, yeah, we what were we all doing all those decades ago? There were fewer opportunities, but were we actually all doing uniform things just because there were fewer TV channels? And I suspect there was a lot more diversity than we have credit.
I think, to be honest with you, I think that things, I mean, I this is just my own personal sort of experience. I don't really have any facts or figures to back this up, but I feel that there was probably it, not exactly more diversity. I think that's a strange kind of way of framing it. I think that perhaps things were a lot less risk adverse. So, you know, you would get all of these Britpop bands kind of getting signed and suddenly being on Top of the Pops. And, you know, every week you'd see somebody on Top of the Pops. You were like, oh, yes, they're one of my bands. I like them. I like them. You know, you would certainly get that. But I do think it's maybe an issue of like whoever is gatekeeping these avenues into people's living rooms back then. There were less opportunities, you know, and you couldn't have someone say just upload themselves playing a guitar onto YouTube because that didn't exist. People had to go out and they had to graft and they had to do the, not say that people don't now, but they had to physically go out, book a gig with somebody, you know, broker that sort of deal, turn up, hope someone would turn up to see their show, publicize their show in whatever ways that they could do through flyers or word of mouth or mixtapes or whatever. You know, place the D-shaped space in front of the stage and really, really do the legwork, really, in it. And only fewer people, I think, would probably do that. Now there are so many more avenues for people. Say if, for example, if you were a musician back then, and you did it because you wanted to be famous. This is actually a strand that runs through my book, actually, through Zaz. And there is one of the main characters in it. He is a musician. He's not very good, but he just desperately wants to be famous. I sort of thought critically, like, you know, if it was a few years later, what would he have actually done? Would he have been in a band? Probably not. He probably would have tried to have gone on something like Big Brother, or the equivalent now would be Love Island or whatever. You know, it probably would be that sort of character, just a bit of a chancer, just trying to get their face out and about on telly and that sort of stuff. I think that there was a lot of people perhaps didn't have as many avenues for whatever the reasons they wanted, really, to announce that they're sort of here. So when we start to think about it, you know, that's sort of what punk did. Punk was there to a certain degree for people to sort of announce, I'm here and this is what I've got to say about the world. You know, music aside, of course. Greil Marcus talks about that in his wonderful book, Lipstick Traces, actually. I don't know if you've ever read that. If you haven't, it's a tough read, but it's an interesting one. You know, where he talks about how it's more about an announcement to the world when somebody goes, I'm in a punk band and I've got a safety pin through my nose or whatever. You know, it's an announcement to the world, say like that I'm here and I'm gonna say all this stuff about what's wrong with society. And that was happening in the 70s. And I think with the 90s, we sort of had more of that punk ethos that perhaps hasn't been encapsulated in those documentaries that I was talking about previously, of kind of more DIY, get up and have a go at things sort of attitude that that we do have today. It's just different. It's just differently presented in a digital age rather than an analog one.
Yeah, and you just made me think as well, because you know, sometimes when I'm on Facebook, all these, I don't know, somebody must think that this is what I'm interested in, but I'll suddenly be shown lots of, like, I don't know, chat shows of the 70s or something, and you've got somebody like somebody from The Clash, or you know, somebody from a band from then, and the presenter would often be very sort of stiff and quite. There may be a condescending attitude, clearly a generational gap, like, oh, what do you young people like, sort of thing. And they'd be all like, oh, why are we being asked these stupid questions? And you watch that, and at the time you might think, oh, the artist is being a bit belligerent or a bit rude. But now you look at it and you think, if you're being asked some quite patronizing questions by somebody whose disdain for what they're asking is so evident, well, of course you're going to respond in that way. And then you think, you wouldn't do that now in the same kind of way. And it was just funny watching. So, rather than just watching the act and think, oh gosh, they went on to have an amazing career or whatever, you're thinking, what are they getting at? Or being asked banal questions like, you just made this film. Are you like the character in the film or whatever? And you're like, yeah, but you can do better than that, because there's no sort of depth to it. And it's that evolution, that the things we took for granted back then that seemed like a part of a very alien world all these decades on.
I think I completely agree with you with that one. I think when we look at, just to pick up on that point, you know, the things that we took for granted, the things that were just the fabric of that sort of world. Again, going back to the novel that I've written, Zazen, as I said, it's presented through the forms of a metafanzine, but I was always really, really interested in those kind of things that you saw and you took for granted, like your NME copies, you know, 70p, as I said, Sit Down the Park, had staples in it, the fanzines that you could pick up for a couple of quid, the t-shirts that you used to buy outside the gigs that would always fall apart by the second time you'd worn them, the hair dye, the, you know, all of that sort of stuff, all the throwaway sort of items that just made up that sort of time. And then suddenly they weren't there anymore. And for me, I felt a great sort of, I say a great sense of loss, like it's like the worst thing in the world that happened. But, you know, I felt like, oh, well, that's really sad that we don't see that anymore. We don't do that anymore. I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, the need for physical books, if people actually want them or not, and the pros and cons of it. I mean, we will get to a time where we perhaps see very few of them. I mean, and I think another thing as well that I found quite interesting. I mean, I'm just going to makes me sound like I live in a right hoarder's house here, but I unearthed a box of old photographs from that era in the early 2000s, like when I was at university and stuff. And it just brought back the memory of having one of those disposable cameras, taking it out on a night out. What, getting something like 22 shots out of it, taking it to the chemist, waiting a week, and then them all being blurry, and like, or you know, you get one or two out of them or whatever. That's such a long, laborious process. Where now we've got a smartphone, you can just click, click, click. There we go. You can take all the photos you want. So, you know, it's things like that. It's all of that like detritus of the age. And that's the sort of stuff that I'm putting in this exhibition, that we're putting in this exhibition. It is those throwaway items. You wouldn't see somebody giving somebody a mixtape now. You wouldn't see somebody sitting around reading a fanzine on the train or something. You wouldn't see, you just don't see people like reading in public much anymore. You
Yeah.
just, you know, it's all that sort of stuff. It's just gone. Even the giveaway flexi discs and tapes you get on a magazine.
Yeah, and those were the days. I mean, the pilgrimages involved in going down, in my case, I used to go down to Swansea when I was living in West Wales on a Saturday because some of the newspapers, the fact that I even called them newspapers because they were magazines, would be giving away like a free video or whatever, literally a video VHS that, you know, you'd that they'd, and of course, they couldn't attach it to the newspaper because of the size, unlike a disc. So, of course, you know, they'd have them under the counter. And if you bought that, if you paid for your magazine, then you'd get the, you know, the video to put in your bag with you. And those are things we took for granted. But I was talking to a student of mine just the other day who was finding it bizarre that if you wanted to read Harry Potter, you'd actually like go to a library and actually walk out with a physical book. You know, she was like, you know, nobody does that kind of thing anymore. But for me, the nostalgia element is not just in terms of the content of, you know, we read this 30 years ago, whatever it might be. It's the fact it's all those rites of passages almost, and the rituals that come with it, that that's what we had to do. You'd have to wait till a certain day in the week. You'd have to wait 6 months before the film that you saw at the cinema came out to rent on, you know, on VHS, and another 6 months before you could then purchase it. And you just took it for granted. But now everything is so much more immediate. But the photograph thing, I mean, that is telling because you know, the days when you'd lose an entire set of photographs because you hadn't wound it all the reel on properly. But now, of course, what do? We immediately post on, well, I do, on Facebook. So suddenly everyone knows on the day where I am, what I'm doing. And there are pros and cons of that. The days of getting something from Boots, as you know, from the chemist, and then I'd run into my university library and see all my friends and say, hey, I've got my photographs, and you know, because you're in it kind of thing. And we'd look at the picture that was taken like a month earlier when we had somebody's party or something, and we'd all look at them and go, oh wow, that was a happy evening. It's kind of funny. And I but it's a strange kind of, it feels like it really belongs to a different realm, a different era now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have this sort of like notion in my head where everything, like the whole world seems to change every 5 years. It sort of feels like that. But then it doesn't change, does it? Because I mean, because I've lived in the same place or the same city all my life. Like, you know, I know like that building's still there, that building's still there. Do you know what I mean? But fundamentally, the fabric of the world seems to have changed. And I think it is up to us to keep up with that. But also it's very interesting to compare and contrast what we've got now with what we've got then, which is part of what I was doing with that novel. The process of me writing Zars, and was about that comparison and that contrast of what's happening now, what's happening in the past. And I think that always happens with novels that are sort of historical to some sort of degree. There is some sort of link to what's going on now. And in Zazen, you know, there's a lot of themes of misogyny in there, which happen. And obviously that still happens now with, like, you know, quite a lot of the campaigns that have happened and stuff. There's a lot of stuff in there about how a lot of stuff in there about racism as well, which obviously I was writing a lot of Zazen through lockdown. So when we had the George Floyd riots and you know, all of that was sort of seeping in. So I sort of do a lot of comparison with the protests that were happening. And bearing in mind I was at home, you know, and I'd hear people having protests around the globe because of what happened there. And the bulk of the novel of Zazen is set in 1994, when we had the emergence of the Criminal Justice Act, and there were lots of protests. Again, whitewashed out of, I say whitewashed out of history. We don't really ever mention this, you know, the fact it was an act that came out as the first kind of direct address on civil liberties and policing people's lifestyles fundamentally. And it was a catch-all, miscellaneous, obble-wobble kind of act that didn't, you know, it wasn't just about raves and trespass, like the media led you to believe in the day and historically. There was all sorts of things in there. So, you know, and I ended up doing a lot of research from home. Thank you, internet. As much as I'm knocking it, it was very useful. You know, watching old videos on YouTube of people protesting from Hyde Park to Downing Street in the second big protest that they did, which, you know, we don't really remember now. And I ended up writing a few chapters around those events, which at the beginning of when I started writing Zazen, and I didn't think it would go that way, but these chapters sort of emerged, and it really, I felt that it did quite encapsulate the time. So I ended up writing a couple of chapters around those protests, where basically two of the journalists, the two female journalists, they get sent by their editor to go to this protest because he saw that he missed out on the first one and they got no coverage in their magazine, the Subculture magazine. So he sends them both down there in hope that they'll get some sort of wild story. And one of them spends the day there and she has a bit of an argument with someone. That's part of the plot. And the second one turns up late, having gone AWOL basically, and her excuse to the whole thing, her solution to having missed the entire protest and not even walking through the gates of Hyde Park is just to make it up. And so then we read the journal article, the newspaper article, the subculture article that they write together with their made up protesters, and you know, and it reads just as authentic as something you would read from the day. So I ended up going on a lot of we're going into internet history here, like those old where people used to, what they called message boards, where people would post, you know, before we really took off with social media, people would post their experiences. And one of them was about protests and dissent. And, you know, it's just sort of there lingering around on the internet. And there were a few firsthand accounts of what actually happened in those protests or what people remember to have happened. So, in a way, it was quite a nice experiment in weaving fact, fiction, buried memories, collective memories. When I say that, I mean, you know, when one person remembers one thing and then someone else goes, oh yeah, I remember that too. Oh, I remember that too. But then, you know, false memories, kind of exaggerated memories, and then just blatant lies. Like these characters, some of them just blatantly lie and go, right, okay, we interviewed that person, they've made them up, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, it was an exercise in comparing and contrasting what actually happened then and what's happening now.
Yeah, and what you're saying there is very telling because I mean I've always kept a diary for that, and I think on some level it's because obviously other people will have a different version of events of something that you witnessed,
Yeah.
but the thing that I've always found difficult to process is when somebody might say, oh, that didn't happen, or no, that I was never there, and you're like, well, because what that means, of course, is that your sense of self is betrayed, is compromised, is confused. And almost it's like, well, if something really matters to me, or if there was something that, changed my life in some way or another, the idea then that somebody would say, oh, no, it didn't happen, wreaks havoc with your sense of, what who you are, what you mean to yourself, what and how you're perceived by others. So having some kind of a record of that. And then when it's there, it's kind of it's okay because at the end of the day, you've got your own corroboration, if you like, of something that happened. But without that, and novels can do the same thing, or because in terms of the way that dealing with people who with memory loss or dementia, it's the and that's something that we might come on to because that is something that. There is always something that's going to sort of effectively encapsulate that essence of, this is who they are, something from the past, something that some object, some memory, some bit of music, whatever it might be, that conjures up something that actually gives them back, because maybe something has been lost, that sense of identity, that sense of self.
So you've said a whole load of stuff in there that I'd love to really unpick. First of all, memory is a really interesting one to work with because it's such a fallible tool. It is a tool. It's the only tool we've got, and it's really imperfect. It's like you know, it's not something you can pick up and is tangible. So that's number one. Number two, just to go back to this exhibition that we're putting on in Leicester, one of the mantras, I'm working on this with my partner actually, because he, you know, I need somebody with a drill basically to help me with this sort of stuff. He always has this mantra about this exhibition. When the ideas are going too far and wide, one of the things he says to sort of bring it back is the main purpose behind this is to bring memories back for people. And I always think that that's a really, really interesting thing because people do forget stuff. As I said, memory is an absolutely fallible tool. It really, really is. And you know, when I started writing Zazen, one of the well, I took on a project with Leicester City Council, the Barring Foundation, Writing East Midlands, and the NHS, you know, where it was like a collaborative sort of endeavor, where I was going around care homes and talking to people who had dementia. And it was a drive to make Leicester the first dementia-friendly city. And actually, I write about this in an article that got published today in Writers in Education, issue 91. So if you want to have a read, yeah. So it was a project where I went around care homes. I would talk to some of the people who are in care homes, either individually or collectively, get them to have a conversation, make a few notes of some of the things they said, use their sort of words, and then scurry myself off into a cupboard or onto a patio somewhere where I'd write a really rough draft of a poem, really, really rough. I wasn't trying to be poet laureate or anything like that, but just a really rough draft of a poem using their memories and their words. And I'd go back to them and I would speak to them and I'd recite the poem and you'd see their eyes light up and the memories come back. Now, I found that to be probably one of the most effective things I've worked on because you got that immediate response from people. It was really, really fulfilling. It was hard, don't get me wrong, it was quite difficult, especially when I was placed in a Vista care home. Now, Vista is a local Leicestershire charity, and they deal with people who've got sight loss, hearing loss, and in the care homes, also people with dementia. So getting these people to sit and have a conversation together was actually really difficult because of the communication issues. So part of the way that I tackled this was begging a box of items from an exhibition from Newark House's museum. So a big thank you to them, where it was all household stuff from the 40s. Half of the stuff I didn't even know what it was, and like you know, getting them to talk about it and getting them to you know evoke those sensory details. So the fairy soap, the smell of it, that in its box, that got them really chatting. The feel of the old brushes, and I was going, "Was this for sweeping the floor?" And they were like, "No, it's for sweeping. It's for brushing down a suit." And I'm like, "What?" And then like the thing that really got them chatting and giggling and laughing was the shiny white toilet paper, which was called Izal. And we wrote a poem, an ode to Izal, which you can read in the article, actually. It's one of the few poems that actually did get published. The idea behind that project, eventually, we were going to put out an anthology of everybody's poetry, and they could have a copy of it themselves. They could give a copy to their relatives or whatever. But unfortunately, COVID put a massive stop to that. So that was really like kind of annoying, really, and it never got picked up again. But it was. I think from that experience, working with those people, seeing how memory kind of worked, that also directly contributed to the construction of Zazen because what that would have been beginning of 2018, 2019, I was working on that. And that would have been when I started really putting together Zazen and really taking it a bit more seriously than I had done the 2 previous years. And really trying to put things together and write things from different characters' perspectives. And in that book, there are certain events that happen. I don't retell the same event over and over and over again. It's not like Ulysses by James Joyce, where it's all set around one day, but there are certain elements of that. So there are two sister chapters in it where somebody's death is basically the climactic thing that happens. And one character relays everything up to that point. So everything in the day beforehand, which is the day before Valentine's Day. And the other character then narrates everything that happens the following day, after that point, after the death. So that's the day after Valentine's Day, and how they bounce off each other as well, and how they don't like each other. And there are certain, you know, how they all basically sort of fall out, these characters do. And there are certain elements in there where, you know, there are certain secrets that the reader knows, but then the characters don't, and certain issues that like some characters know that other characters don't. So in a way, it's quite a complex thing to sort of juggle. And then there's another chapter towards the end where they reflect upon that, and different people's perspectives are quite tarnished by time. They kind of go, there's an element of, well, what we did, was it right or was it wrong? You know, and evaluative. And some people are very convinced that what they did was the rightest sort of thing, and some people are very convinced that it was the worst sort of thing. And really, it leaves the reader up to themselves to call their own judgments. In a way, it's structured in that way to be a bit mean to the reader, to trip them up a little bit, so they'll follow a certain narrative along the way. and maybe trust a character, and then the character might do something that doesn't sit well with their moral sensibilities, and then do they switch allegiance or do they not? Ooh.
Yeah, and do you find then that it's almost like you had to write this? I mean, do you kind of feel that constant re kind of questioning of or reframing of the past, and just that sometimes it's that, and that's the thing about nostalgia, isn't it? It's often that mismatch between what goes on in our imagination and what we think happened, where we are now, that sort of disjuncture, and that sort of liminal space that's opened up becomes a site of such creativity. It sounds to me as though it's like, that there was no alternative but to write this, because you're channeling something that's not, you're not doing it for the sake of it. You're not doing it because somebody has said, you need to write X number of novels, like a sort of like university ref process. This sounds like something deeply existential.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I would say that it was something I felt like I felt drawn to write. Absolutely, yes. And that's something I've examined as well, the process of feeling drawn to write something and all of that sort of stuff. It's come out in various bits and bobs of academic writing that I've done. I would say, I mean, I was doing a little bit of, I say a little bit of work. I was doing some studying with De Montfort University at the time, and they've got the Centre for Adaptations there. And we did an awful lot of stuff at the time. I was studying English. We ended up looking at a lot of things. I said we. I ended up looking at a lot of things where there were adaptations of different, like film adaptations of various novels, that sort of thing. And it was quite interesting to just examine what sometimes people would put in to make a good story and what people would leave out. I've always had a great fascination, and I mean a great fascination with autobiographies. I've always loved reading them. In fact, I haven't read one. For, no, I lie. I say I haven't read one for a while, but I read Tracy Emin's one, which had to be hunted down from Fosse Park as a Christmas present for me, apparently, which was an absolute epic pilgrimage and journey to try and get that book. I really like biographies. I've always read a lot of biographies, and again, I think it was just having a conversation with a friend and saying to them, "Oh, well, that was that biography I read. Do you think that was really they were really like that? It was very different to how I imagined that real life person to be. What's he called? Anthony Kiedis's Scar Tissue. I remember reading that one from the Red Hot Chili Peppers and thinking, it's not what I expected, because people present themselves in a biography in a certain sort of way. And again, it's looking for those gaps. Perhaps somebody else's point of view is completely different. I mean, one of my favorite ways to explain it is that I always say, well, Donald Trump's biography, autobiography written by himself, be the same as what everybody else in the world
No, well,
sees.
exactly, but you've just made me think of something else, because I've read autobiography sometimes where there are just occasions when you're thinking, "Ooh, did this person sit down and write it, or did somebody, the ghost writer, or is there a is it through a succession of interviews that somebody else guided that conversation?" I remember reading, and it may have been Bill Clinton a long time ago. I remember reading his, and at the end of it, the list of people who'd helped him. And he listed all the researchers, and I thought, oh, and suddenly I felt I'd finished reading it, and I thought, hang on a minute, this was a composite work. Now, obviously, it's in the first person, and it's obviously his story. And it's obviously the case. If you've been a president of the United States, you're obviously gonna make sure that there are things that are you fact check them, and because there are consequences if you get something wrong, and people may be quite offended, or you diplomatically it's not very. And you also want to ensure, you mentioned Trump, you want, in a way, you want your narrative, your version of events to be preserved. But is that another angle as well, that sometimes with autobiographies, that they're no different from biographies in the sense that the person who's writing them is not sort of literally just sitting there and saying, I'm going to tell my story. That there's an investment of people who want a particular story to be told in a particular way, and that actually it's much more of a corporate thing. I don't know if that's something that you've picked up on.
Absolutely, yes. I would say. I mean, to go back to my own writings, that in itself, that started off as a speculative biography of a scene. I use that wording because, for me, I wanted it to be a biography of a time frame rather than of a person. That was the real key kind of thing that I was trying to put together. But it turned out I changed the word into a fictional biography of a scene fundamentally when I was talking about it, because it was a fictionalized version of it, although it's still a biography. Now, the reason why I wanted to do it rather than just from one person's point of view, because I had had a write of it where a draft of that novel back in the past when I was faffing around with the ideas, where it was from one single person's point of view. And I felt that I couldn't encapsulate everything about that scene just in that one character's point of view. It was multifaceted and experienced, the 90s, it was experienced in very different ways by very different people based on their identity, their social class, their race, their everything, really, And that in itself, I wanted to capture. Now, on top of that, you say, nostalgia being kind of package, so to speak. Is that really
Well,
what?
or certainly there's a sense in which it's not the purity of, it's not like this, we want to re-invoke or re-experience what happened. It's told from the vantage point of now and maybe something missing. So
Yeah.
there's a repackage, no, and definitely a repackaging in that front, in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, like as I said, I think previously when we were chatting, nostalgia is a huge market. It absolutely is. And I think one of the best ways to illustrate that is the concept of a cover song. We think about it. Recently, I say recently, I'm showing my age in the way that like 5 years ago is recent in my mind. That sort of thing. I think, oh, that happened yesterday. I say recently, use that lightly. I think Miley Cyrus ended up doing a whole load of covers of various different songs from the 80s and the 90s, and songs with bands as well, where she would do her own version. She did a song with Metallica. She did a cover of Hole's Doll Parts, which is actually pretty good. She did a whole load, she did a cover of like a few Nine Inch Nails songs, these proper American kind of grunge and heavy metal bands, which was quite unexpected, I think, for somebody who was Hannah Montana. But I sort of wondered about this, and I took a step back of initial outrage and sort of started going, well, the reason why she's done this is because not only is it appealing to the kids today, to the teenagers, it's also appealing to their parents' generation. It's something that a whole family can enjoy together, which is wonderful. And it opens up the younger generation to certain things that the older generation would have experienced and enjoyed the first time around, as you were saying about The Cure earlier on. And then, on top of that, it becomes big bucks, it becomes big business. And when these cover songs, it's very postmodern of me to say this, they're more of a they're not a parody like a Weird Al Yankovic sort of a cover song. They're a pastiche, they're very heartfelt and sincere kind of like homages. And then when you actually start to really think about it in more and more depth, you've got probably some of the greatest cover songs. I mean, I would hold my hands up and just say that Johnny Cash's Hurt is probably one of the greatest cover songs of all time. It's a Nine Inch Nails song, but Johnny Cash, I think, was the last thing that he released. And it's done it with such deep sincerity. It brings something more back to the song. He makes that song his own. So really, in a way, when we start to think about the commercialization of nostalgia, it is there. Maybe it's not such a bad thing. It's the compare and contrast. It's evaluative, isn't it? It's like, it is lining someone's pockets, but the reason why it does that is because it appeals to something in our humanity, in our hearts and in our minds. And what that is, it's something unquantifiable in a way. It makes us, it gives us something new. The Mark Fishers and the Ardonos of this world would get very upset about this, this idea of it being pre-packaged and reserved back to us the same stuff, because fundamentally it is just the same song that's just put on a different suit, different singer is wearing it, it's sold back to us, we subscribe, we buy the copy again, we download it again, we might have had it in our, dare I say it, tape collections or record collections in the past, but we'll go and get a new version of it, and it is the same thing, we're just paying more out for it. Yes, it's not new stuff, but maybe the familiarity in there just helps us assimilate what it is fundamentally.
And sometimes when an event is happening, I mean, there are this is when again when a diary is handy, but there might be evenings or times when just like especially in the pre-social media days when everything would just fall into place at just the right moment that you almost couldn't anticipate that suddenly all your friends are there in one place and you're thinking, this is good. You know, I'll remember this for the rest of my
Mm.
life. And that need to preserve that, almost like that purity, almost like that, whatever the essence is of a good life or sort of an optimum experience, that you've kind of accomplished something. Or there's the sense sometimes that we read back into the past something that may actually be a composite of different experiences, and
Yeah.
actually we're sort of all sticking it into one, like, you know, a series of, you know, and it's like we remember the good things, we remember the bad things, but we lump all the good things together, the bad things together, but actually if we were to go back in time, we'd find that it wasn't really like that. It was more nuanced as it is, you know, for us now. And I wonder exactly what we're trying to do with the past. What are we trying to reinvoke?
Well, interestingly, one thing that came up quite a bit when I was doing research, oh God, the research for this novel just went completely haywire at one point. took me down all sorts of rabbit holes. But one thing that I found, which was quite a comparable text to what I was doing with Zazen with the form, and again, what you're saying with the content, this idea of trying to examine the past, trying to look at something from different angles, try and preserve it, try and capture it, try and, you know, conserve it, I suppose, really, in a sort of way. Just and the purpose is for me to examine and to analyze it. I ended up looking at Walter Benjamin's Arcades project. I don't know if you've ever come across that, but it is a tome of a book. It's, you know, if you want a paving slab replaced on your road, go get that book. It's great big fat heavy thing. It's massive. Now, what Walter Benjamin was trying to do is his great unfinished work, and it's set in Paris. I say it's set in Paris. It's about Paris's arcades in the interwar years. So fundamentally, it's a scrapbook of photographs, overheard conversations, snippets of things, different people's writing, different musings on these arcades in Paris where people just sort of went and hung out. And he spent, I don't know, I want to say 20 years, I might be wrong, you know, collecting all of this evidence and rearranging it and rearranging it and rearranging it for absolutely decades and adding more to it and adding more to it. And it's not a readable text, as in you pick it up and you read it from page one to page 1,000, because it is like that. You know, it's not that sort of book. It's a dip in, dip out sort of compository of nonsense, really. But again, this is what he's trying to do. I found a comparison there, really, with my own work, that he was trying to examine these arcades and what they meant to humanity, really, what they meant to these people who lived in Paris. And fundamentally, what I was trying to do was examine what this scene that sort of seemed to actually spontaneously emerge in that time, a little bit before the commercialization and the Britpop label, you know, examine what that actually meant to people. You know, how did it affect people? You know, especially people of a certain sort of age and a certain sort of era, and how it drew lots of people together who were from very different backgrounds. Because that, as I said before, the diversity that was presented within Britpop was something that really, really massively appealed to me. So I saw them both as sort of comparable texts, really, in a way, although both are really massively different. And again, being able to look at the differences between them was quite useful when it came to structuring Zazen, in the fact that, like, I knew that juxtaposition would be a key thing. That's what Walter Benjamin does. He uses a lot of juxtaposition, but you can't read it from A to B. I wanted Zazen to be able to actually have a narrative storyline. So I ended up having to use the juxtaposition of these chapters, these paratextual chapters, putting them together side by side so that would make the reader want to read on and go, oh, okay, so we've seen this character's point of view on this. Now we need to see what the next character, you know, is it going to be a complete contrast? Has she completely made everything up now?
Yeah, and also something that we were saying just before we started recording as well is almost the way that in the past things were appeared to be anyway more monolithic, and it was the case of, you know, this is the perspective. You know, I'd watch films in the 90s about white men with their midlife crises. These were the big American thrillers of the 90s. You know, the with Michael Douglas or Harrison Ford. would play, and you'd watch them. And it was only, I think, really when you look back and Nomadland, when that won Best Picture Oscar a few years ago, made me then realize that, of course, there are other stories. And it was just that, you're not able to critique things at the time they're happening. But when you go back over your own life sometimes, and you suddenly realize that actually maybe the set of friends or the set of experiences don't seem very diverse, then it's like, well. And it leads on to the next question I wanted to ask you, which is about what we do with those, like, can you be nostalgic in a good way anyway, about things that actually don't that are missing? Do we want to go back and revisit the past through the lens of something that might be a bit more diverse or a bit more inclusive from the point of view of today? Or do we sort of say, well, that's how it was then, let's celebrate it in whatever it was that we did then, and it's a bygone age? How do we do that?
That's a really, really interesting one because that is something that I think is a bit of an ongoing debate. So, yeah, I mean, you can look back at certain things now with hindsight and with new knowledge and go, yeah, that weren't right. absolutely. It's looking back on certain things and going, yeah, no, that really, I mean, for example, there's a whole load of, archive material from Top of the Pops, yeah, which is on BBC iPlayer or whatever, on YouTube and whatnot. Now, there's a whole load of episodes of Top of the Pops that aren't allowed to be shown because of certain people that are on Top of the Pops of the day. It's almost like, these have been removed and they have been erased because it's a proven fact that what happened there wasn't right. Again, it's like I had this a bit of this debate actually in my own writing. I was thinking with some of the language that I used in Zazen, and I really did think like, to sort of maybe capture some of the microaggressions that really did happen in the day, some of the ways people would speak to each other and about each other in the 90s, which really, by today's standards, absolutely would not be not fly, absolutely not. And I ended up James Cook, who I think he wrote a memoir about music actually. So it's sort of his life memoir through music. He read 10, oh God, he wrote me a 10-page report actually on Zazen as I was writing it. And one of the questions I asked him, and this was through the literary consultancy actually, who again a wonderful free read scheme that I got the benefit of using, thanks to Writing East Midlands. One of the questions I asked was, do you think I should leave some of this language in, some of these things the way they talk to each other in? And he said that it's probably, although it does capture the nuance of the time, it's probably not the debate that you want to be getting yourself into as with your first novel, basically. And I thought, yeah, that's a really, really interesting one to kind of put out there. So I think for the sake of I mean, it's a rich and interesting kind of topic to discuss, but in a way, there's no real closure on it, I find. There's no real right or wrong. You can't say this is exactly the way it should be on this instance, and then that's verbatim, and that's like, applies to all situations. I think each one has to be looked at on its own individual kind of merits. It's really hard to call that one.
Yeah, and it's also the integrity of memory, because I think it, I mean, I find that it's very easy to and actually necessary to critique the past, in the sense that the things we might be nostalgic about are things that actually are kind of appalling. You might be nostalgic for something that, a particular something that excluded people because, it was sort of like, well, that's what we did. We went to that club or we went to that event, and it was, we were privileged to be able to do it or whatever it was. And you don't think more. Inverted commas, peripheral voices, shall we say, or people who were not part of that mainstream heteronormative culture were, you didn't think about them. I look at school and just think how, there was a sort of a set way of doing things that you didn't think. I mean, people with what we would now, the first thing we would do is sort of say, is everyone included? A classroom situation where everybody sits and listens to the teacher attentively. If you had hyper, some form of hypersensitivity or your ADHD or autism, in those days you'd just be seen as a problem child, like, oh, that person
Absolutely.
can't sit still, or that person's not engaged, or that person's being disobedient. And I look back with horror at the way in which in those days, if somebody didn't follow a particular line, you'd be humiliated. You might even have, in a previous age, maybe even certainly when I was at primary school, there were cases of people getting the cane. You've been talking in class, or you didn't sit still. And I look back on that now and just think, you could never want to go back to that time in a kind of sort of, oh, childhood was the happiest days of our lives. Very far from it.
I think maybe one of the ways to actually approach it, and I do actually do this. So I'm a module leader in the undergraduate creative writing degree at De Montfort University, and I teach a lot of the first years. And I head on a unit called Writing Identity, and there's a session on intersectionality and positionality that I do. And I think one of the great ways to analyze how we are in the world and how we relate to others in that respect is this. It's really old, actually. It's from 1992. It's something Harvard came up with, which was the axis of privilege and oppression. And it's this wheel thing. And it's really outdated, really, really outdated. But it's got different forks that come off it. And these are things that are on the top are things that are privilege, and on the bottom are things that are oppressors. So, and as I said, it's really, really outdated. There are so many more things you could add to that now. This wheel thing could just keep growing. And I do ask students to do that. I say, look, what do you think is missing? That's why we start with that. But they look at that, and it gives them a bit of an overview of what things they have in their lives, which are privileges, and what things they have in their life, which are systems of oppression, really, for them. So, looking at something like that is really, really interesting when it comes to getting people to see exactly where they are. And then it also helps them make judgments, I say make judgments on other people. And from my point of view, because I'm a writer and obviously I'm teaching creative writing, on their characters. So in a way, it gets them to start thinking, well, why are all of these characters like this? Now, a really weird thing I used to do, and this was just weird. I say when I started writing, when I started writing, it wasn't until probably about 10 years ago, really. All of my characters were white. They were white. They were female. They were all told from first person perspective. I had a fair amount of success in this. Now, as a mixed race woman, when I started writing Zazen, it became a bit of a challenge for me to write. One of the characters who sometimes I argue with the main protagonist in it, sometimes I don't, because it doesn't have one central narrative voice that Zazen doesn't. I wrote a character who was a mixed race male, and instead of being half Chinese like I am and half white, I actually made him half Indian and half white. And to write that in itself was more like writing my own experience, although it wasn't my experience, than writing these characters who were these middle class kind of white girls I'd written about before. Now, I often wondered, why did I write these characters like that? Now, it's because a lot of the things that I'd read had characters in them like that, especially seeing as I enjoy writing, reading fiction about music. I enjoy writing it, I enjoy reading it. Now, I found that there are not a lot at all of there are not a lot of novels written about music. Publishers really hate them because they think that you can't capture that art form into literature. There's generally a bit of a hatred towards them, but I love it. So that's number one. Number two, that I've not found one that's not written by a white author, and I've looked because I love reading them. So if anyone finds one, do tell me. Please do. And mostly they're written by male authors. So we tend to get novels like David Keenan's This Is Memorial Device, which was a bit of a big seller back in the days. We've got and I absolutely take my hat off to him because I think he's a wonderful, wonderful writer, but I am going to say, and a wonderful support to me as well, I'm going to say Guy Mankowski's Dead Rock Stars and How I Left the National Grid, great writer in that sort of field. We've got Matt Osman, who actually is the bass player from Suede, writing The Ruins, which is a wonderful music fiction crime sort of thrillery book. Again, It's all these writers coming from this one demographic that seems to be fulfilling a very narrow space anyway. So it just seemed like something I had to do. I just had to write it because no one else is gonna.
Yeah, and this is kind of unstoppable. I find that in teaching, that suddenly the things that I took for granted, the stuff I was taught, I look at the students in front of me, and sometimes you just know from their reactions that, you can't just replicate the same things. I used to think there was almost this objectivity, like this is the answer to the question, in the sense of, these are the core figures and this is what they represented. But then you're questioning, why are these the core figures? So there's that evolution. I've got one more question for you, which is, because I'm fascinated. It's not the question that I perhaps normally end with, although I can ask you that one as well. But it was actually more of me thinking that because you're so engaged with all of these big questions from the early 2000s, would your early 2000 self have imagined that would have been like almost like the repository for all this creative work that you're doing lately? How would that younger self feel about the fact that that period was being, I'm not going to use the word eulogized, but a sense that it is deemed to be so important, which could you have at the time have imagined that there was that was going to be almost the blueprint for everything that you've gone on to do?
So back in the 2000, so what? I graduated my undergrad 2005, and then swiftly after that, I mean, it wasn't like I didn't I had a day job, don't get me wrong. So yeah, I had a day job, working for a charity that worked with the homeless, actually did funding bids for them. That was all right. But I was desperately trying to launch my career as a writer, trying to get into every competition, every sort of thing I could. And fundamentally, I wrote about what I knew. I wasn't there writing fantasy or science fiction or any sort of genre fiction. I wrote about what I knew, and I got like marginal successes and stuff. I wrote a lot of stuff about the kind of worlds that I was living in, the kind of shared houses and the sort of eating tin food and a lot of that sort of stuff, going and seeing live music and going out to different places and experiencing that sort of world. And I did write about that a lot, but I also found as well that I got a lot of knockbacks from that, because a lot of people just I wrote a lot about female friendship, I would say, back then, because that was a huge, huge part of that time for me. Like, I lived with two very long term, I mean, still friends with them now, two friends, and we had a fantastic time. But yeah, I wrote a lot about the ins and outs and the nuances of female friendships. So certain instances that I wrote about which actually happened. I remember one a short story which had a character walk into somebody's bedroom and throw the alarm clock out the window, which is something that actually happened. Yeah, so there was definitely the blueprint was certainly set there. But I think in what I've actually created and the way that I've cherry picked, again, memory being, if I'd written a memoir, it would have been very different, but cherry pick certain elements from these characters and then sort of put them all together. I mean, again, in this novel, in Zazen, one of the things you could possibly say that, people who know me and take a bit of a blueprint from my life would say, well, I've got two very close female friends who I've known, since childhood. And you could argue that there are three women in this book who are very, very close friends. Although you couldn't say, oh, that one's that person, that one's that person, that one's that person. They are their own characters. But I've obviously taken from that blueprint, the blueprint of having a little gang of mates in that respect. And that shines through even now in what I write and in this novel. I mean, I'm hoping they don't read it and go, which one am I supposed to be? I'm hoping that doesn't happen. I'm hoping we'll certainly have a conversation about that, probably over a glass of wine and some cake. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest that this is the blueprint of a lot of the things that all came together. I feel that it was such an important part of my life and still is, I would say. It's not something I leave. It's like, when people go, it's just a phase. It's just a phase that you dyed your hair pink or whatever. And I'd be like, well, It's not a phase.
Yeah, and it's
It's
not a
actually a lot
phase when the things that from childhood sometimes are still
of
with you decades on. And other people might have said, oh, it's just a phase you're going through, but you're like, no, this is actually the core me. And stuff that the professional stuff you go on to do, or the serious stuff, the adult stuff, actually is not, in a way, that's just a smoke screen almost
Absolutely. It does
for
feel a
what
bit
you'd
like
always known
that.
that you are. Yeah.
It's a little bit like what's it people always say, adulting is really hard. It's like they're still stuck with the mindset of a teenager sometimes. I think the thing is though, you've got to have fun, haven't you, I suppose? And you've got to be able to laugh at yourself and laugh at who you were and laugh at who you are now and sort of poke fun at yourself a bit, or else what is you can't go around being so serious all the
It has been amazing, Sabrina,
time.
to go on this journey, and
Thank
actually
you.
this creativity. I'm like, I'm going to read your work. It's like
Okay.
this intersects on every level with that whole sense of trying to make sense of who we are, where we've come from, where we're going. But Sabrina, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Oh, thank you. Thank you ever so much.